Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. On the Radio Gorgeous sofa today, we have Wanda Whiteley, who is the author of The Gold Hanger Dog, a magical tale of two misfits in the wild marshes of East Anglia. Welcome, Wanda.
Hello. Lovely to be here, Donna.
Could you introduce us to the story of The Gold Hanger Dog?
The Gold Hanger Dog is about a misfit called Della, who's 15, and she lives in a very small village called Gold Hanger, which is on the Blackwater Estuary, if anyone knows that. It's got Ozy Island in the middle, where in fact the final showdown happens, and Malden, which is famous for the salt, at one end. And it was a very rich place, actually, in those days. And Mary Tudor owned quite a lot of it. She was princess at that time. Edward VI was, in fact, lying on his deathbed during the weeks of the novel. And our girl Della, the misfit, gets caught up in this strange time with a fight for succession, very topical today. She is someone who has a very odd bond with animals, and the gift with the animals gets much, much stronger, and it starts to terrify her. But one thing the gift with animals does is it draws her to this funny little dog called Turnspit. And Turnspit is a turnspit dog, largely forgotten now, but because they're extinct. They went extinct after the mechanised spit took over in manor houses and inns, and they had them in North America, all over. And this poor little dog was kept in a strange wheel-type cage high up on the kitchen wall in the boiling hearth, where it had to tread, turning the wheel, and the wheel turned the spit. And so Della is a Tudor rescuer who manages to rescue Turnspit, and together they embark on this strange adventure.
One of the aspects of the novel is that it's an historical novel. As you said, you've Mary Tudor, you evoke that so completely. I mean, from the Turnspit dog to all of the clothing references, the food references. Did you do a tremendous amount of research?
I'm probably a lazy researcher, because some people have done it so well that I bought several books on Tudor pastimes, on how to live as a Tudor. I'm a huge fan of Ian Mortimer, who's written, I'm trying to think what they're called, but he's done one on medieval England and one on Shakespearean, and you get a huge feel for what it was like. And then there's the madly nutty, I probably shouldn't say that, Ruth Goodman, who wrote How to Be a Tudor. And they've all been enormously helpful. She actually sort of dresses as a Tudor and says, no, you don't smell if you don't wash. No, you just rub yourself with a piece of linen. So there's a lot of that sort of reading I did. And I didn't want it to be full of detail, because I didn't want anything to get in the way of a fast-paced plot. So yes, you might have them eating a certain thing or eating off a wooden trencher or something, but it's not full of those descriptive passages. So as you say, you sort of absorb it and then hope. But like any, I'm not a professional historian, so like anybody, I had all sorts of things I came across later. I even had someone smoking a pipe, and I thought, hang on, wrong time, you know, and the family Bible. And I thought, no, can't have a family Bible. So there were all sorts of anachronisms that slip into one's, it slipped into my writing, and I just had to go through on the next further drafts and spot them, really.
Yes, as you say, it is lightly applied, yeah. but it is
well, I'm
immersive.
Glad you fell for it.
Yes, exactly. You fooled someone. And talk to me about, because another thing that is evoked, which you did just mention, is the setting.
Yes. So the setting, the strange thing was, Donna, was that I had not visited, so it was all from research. I didn't really want to go and see it as it is now. And in fact, I went after the first draft and then had to change things. So I went round Colchester Castle, for instance, and thought, whoops, hang on, that wouldn't have been this, that and the other. And sort of the topography of the castle and all of that. I knew from pictures it was marsh, and I'd read books about the Blackwater Estuary. There were some marvellous walking books and sailing books I read. So you can glean stuff that way. But I didn't actually visit till afterwards, but it is a bizarre, weird place. And you can stand on Goldhanger Creek looking out at the Blackwater. And it really hasn't changed. You feel it wouldn't really change. There's no buildings on the skyline. There's nothing except for birds and weed and, these strange fingers of marshland. And it's a very old-fashioned place and a rather unearthly place. It has a strange, compelling quality. It's very different from the sort of Bucket and Spade little golden coves of the West Country, say, but has this huge allure and very few tourists. It's you're out there walking those salt paths on the marshes and things, and you really just feel like you're the last person on earth. Very, very lovely place.
And sort of a perfect place to set a story that has some magical qualities, yes, to it.
And traditionally, of course, it was where they had the witch hunts. So it was a hotspot for magic. Why, I don't know, but there were various people who were persecuted. And yes, I think that the fact that you've got this sort of flock of slightly strange ravens who come to her aid. There's a very old raven from the island of Osy who comes to her help in four key moments in the plot. But I think, I don't think many historical novelists these days have done the magical realism bit very much. I mean, I really wanted to do that. It just sort of popped in somehow. But I'm a great fan, and most people have forgotten her really now, but Elizabeth Googe and the Little White Horse was a favourite, and in fact it's an absolute favourite of J.K. Rowling as well. And Elizabeth Googe was in Oxford at the same time as C.S. Lewis, I think, and was largely overlooked for being a woman, I think, because she's just as good as C.S. Lewis. And doing very things that C.S. Lewis did, I think, if anything, after her. She was one of those pioneering writers. It's quite religious, but then my book has that, because it's set in a time when religion was absolutely all important. I think it has a touch of the Googe magic.
I found the magical quality hugely satisfying. And it brought me back to sort of being a teenager myself and really wanting a superpower. You know what I mean? And I think that's quite common, like, because it's a quite a powerless time in your life,
yeah,
especially as a female. And so I thought it was really satisfying in that way. And there's something nostalgic about it for me.
Yes.
So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Another thing I found was a very unique take on Lady Mary.
Yes.
Because never before have I seen her, including in Hilary Mantel's books, have I seen her as an actor, as the person who is making decisions in her life.
Yeah.
She's always depicted as, you know,
yeah,
the victim and other people making decisions in her life. And you...
I think she's... Do you know, I think she's still a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I think that subsequent generations of Protestantism have blackened her name quite extraordinarily. I mean, she put to death 300 people. Elizabeth did just as much. And Henry did 30,000 or something extraordinary. I mean, you know, the difference. But it was, I think, an anti-Catholic feeling that painted her. She isn't physically attractive. She looks very ordinary, and she, you know, she's not a princess you can conjure with particularly. But she's also full of, she's playful apparently. I mean, they said she gambled, she loved playing cards and bowls, and, you know, was hunting, and, you know, she was quite adventurous in her way. But she also was very indecisive, and I think because she had had this awful childhood, she just lacked sort of, she had moral certitude or religious certitude, but she was wobbly in other ways, and she was longing, I think, to have a husband and children and just be an ordinary woman. That's how she's portrayed, I think. But she still is really weird, and I've got her. I mean, whether she works or not in the book, I don't know, because she is 1 minute the lovely saviour of our girl, our misfit, and the next she sort of turns on her in the most terrible way and is really quite cruel. And I think that Mary, and for instance, she, once she's queen, she is terrified, she can't take decisions, her counsellors turn on her or run rings around her. And yet she did this extraordinary held out for the crown and fled, you know, 55 miles in virtually one horse ride, you know, up to Kenninghall, one of her strongholds in Norfolk. And, you know, she had to change clothes with a serving woman. And, you know, it was quite an extraordinary adventure. And she held out and she got to Kenninghall and she got into the great chamber of Kenninghall, called the entire household, and said, "Damn it, I'm queen. You know, just call me queen. That's who I am. And whatever, you know, even if we've got these two armies following us, I am the rightful queen."
Because she's always portrayed, she must have some metal, and more metal than we've been led to believe. Because she's always portrayed as, you know, frail and this and that. But, you know, and I found your portrayal of her more three-dimensional than I've read before. And I really enjoyed that. And with a lot of complexities, and which, when you think about it, I don't know, with a sort of modern day psychological perspective, of course she was paranoid and vengeful, and, you know, felt like she had moral rectitude on her side, and, you know, all of this. It's understandable. Like, it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, with her experience.
I think probably if you were a Midwest American or something, you'd understand the religion more than we do here in a largely irreligious country in some ways. And it was so huge. I mean, when you read about Mary, I mean, sometimes she was going to mass 7 times a day. So obviously you can't portray that in a book because it would send everyone to sleep.
A bit repetitive.
But, you know, it does sort of, you do realise that they were completely obsessed by religion.
Yes, I mean, and she had her mother's example, who was also, her religion was her life. And that was her marriage. That was her life. That was her very reason, you know, for doing everything she did. It's a very, very interesting.
But you want to sort of, you want to get to the bottom of someone's character. And it really is quite difficult because there's so little except for official documents. So you actually, as a fiction writer, you just imagine your way into it from what little you know. You sort of try and join the dots in a way that's satisfying to you, because I honestly think we don't know, really.
No, we can't know. We can't know. But, and that's to say, yes, that's all historical, but there's also a lovely romance. There's a big sting in the tail there.
Yeah.
There's a couple of, you know, sort of dramas between characters. Anyway, I would highly recommend it. It was a really satisfying and enjoyable, exciting read.
So pleased you liked it.
Excellent. I did. One of the reasons you said you wrote this mm-hmm. is that you are a script doctor.
Yeah.
So you've been telling people what to do.
Yeah, for many decades.
So you took your turn there. Tell me a bit about being a script doctor. And what...
I suppose it came out of... just a need for a change in career, because I'd been a commissioning editor at HarperCollins for many years, and I'd had enough, really. I'd had enough of you know, just doing things the same ways, and I think it was very satisfying when I set up Manuscript Doctor to not be the person saying sorry, no, because of course 80% of the things you're sending out is rejection letters when you're in a publisher, but I thought, well, I'll do the nice bit, the bringing them on, bringing a manuscript on. And then if they say, oh, can you help me with the marketing? You say, no, thank you very much. That's the hard bit. Sorry, no. So, it's been extremely rewarding. And, you know, one thing I've loved is, which I hadn't realised, was taking a manuscript by a novelist who's done it for the first time, and it has all the, you know, they're not fully entrenched with skills and whatever, but when you explain things and they go away and cry and grind their teeth, but actually the ones that get stuck in and might come back a year later with another draft, and it is extraordinary what they manage to do, and that is really nice. The teacher in you is But I really enjoyed the book. Actually, allowed me to do some workshopping, and I love doing that. And talking at schools. So I want to do more talking at schools, because the book does actually extend itself to the sort of 12-year-old very well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I love doing the schools.
You're more of a script mentor.
A script mentor, yeah, really. It'd be nice.
Tell me about your first published work, I believe, mm-hmm. Was a memoir that you co-wrote.
It was. It was a book called Street Kid, and weirdly enough, I was allowed to publish and write it because, you know, our imprint was rather a renegade one at HarperCollins. So I'd heard this wonderful woman talking on the John Peel show, the Saturday morning one, with John Peel. And I thought, gosh, you're amazing. Because she'd lived as a street child and then in the 50s, but now is doing this amazing work with Scots to help in the townships of South Africa. And it was just incredible what she'd been through and what she... and how dedicated she was now. And she took me off to South Africa with her, and we went to visit these little township charities, tumble top charities. Everyone kept sending her with these huge jumpers they'd knitted for, and the woman at the charities was saying, I'd rather not have any more jumpers. Could we possibly have Calpol? It was, he wanted more Calpol. It made me laugh. But she used to say, I know what it's like being a destitute orphan. And she said, I can see it in their eyes, they can see it in my eyes, and they trust me. And she'd been crawling into pipes where these street children were hiding, and, you know, extraordinary. I saw it firsthand and I thought, goodness me, amazing what how people bring their lives around like that. So she's called Judy Westwater, and the book's still available. I think it probably is an ebook, but it was very, it took off in a big way, and as part of the sort of misery memoir chain of books at that time. So yes, it was very good. Did very well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Wanda.
Well, thank you.
Please go to Wanda's website. It's wandawhiteley.com. Or if you want manuscript advice, go to manuscriptdoctor.co.uk.
Thank you.
All that information can be found on our website. Thank you so much for listening. Radio Gorgeous.